From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, starring the entire Nelson family.
The middle-class, relatively egalitarian society was created in a very short period of time, between the late 1930s and the end of World War II.
Once upon a time in America, there was a large middle class. My own parents had secure jobs, affordable housing, and even some money in the bank. But in this economy, those things are getting harder and harder to come by for everyone, and especially for Latinos.
I think the story is distressing for the middle class in America in general. It's even more distressing for the Latino population.
Just what makes Latinos so at risk, hanging by a thread? Today on Latino USA, the experience of the new Latino middle class. And remembering San Antonio labor activist Emma Tenayuca. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Overzealous immigration enforcement is being blamed on a slate of recent reports of wrongful detentions across the country. Joining us to discuss these reports is John Trasviña, President and General Counsel for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or MALDEF. Welcome to Latino USA, John.
Thank you, Maria. Happy to be with you.
You know, John, what really made me start thinking about this issue was when I read in the New York Times about a woman who was detained in Arkansas. She was detained on something not tied to immigration, but she was undocumented. And they basically put her in a detention room and forgot about her for 4 days. And here's somebody without food or water or a bathroom for 4 days detained in our country. And I just said, what's going on here?
It is inexcusable. And what makes it even worse, that situation in Washington County, Arkansas, that's one of the counties where the federal government has gone in and said, we want you as local law enforcement to help us enforce federal immigration laws. So it's not just any county that's doing this. It's a county that supposedly was trained by the federal government. Now, in the situation of the woman in Arkansas, it was inhumane to be left for 4 days during a snowstorm in a cell, 9 foot by 10 foot, with no water, no food, no toileting facilities. We have to put a stop to that. We are calling upon both the Attorney General and Secretary Chertoff to abandon these memorandum of understanding, these so-called federal local agreements to enforce the immigration laws. It's a problem for the people who are individually picked up, but it's even worse. It permeates through the entire communities. We know from the FBI hate crime statistics reports that hate crimes against Latinos have gone up 25% over the last 3 years. It is because the perpetrators of these crimes know that the barriers are going up between local police and communities that make it more difficult for people to report crimes, either as witnesses or as victims. That leaves them as great victims of opportunity to perpetrators, and that is another vestige of the war on immigration. It ends up being a war against our community.
I'm sure that there are people who are listening to this, John, who will say, well, but these people have no legal right to be in the United States. And so if it goes badly for them, well, it's a problem for them, but they shouldn't have been here in the first place. So, you know, what do you want them to take away from the fact that, you know, these detentions are happening?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is that as a matter of constitutional law, the Constitution protects all persons, not all citizens, not all persons legally here, but all persons. All individuals have rights in this country, and the treatment that individuals are getting certainly violates their rights. But second of all is the fact that there is racial profiling going on, plain and simple. And it is not, as someone once said to me, well, that's the price you pay for looking Hispanic. You have to be proving your citizenship or showing your documents more than other people. That's also against the law. And even in these difficult times, they're unacceptable.
So recently, the San Antonio offices of MALDEF prosecuted the case of a vigilante rancher who detained a family of American citizens who were Latinos, detained them on public lands along the border. Our listeners may also be familiar with the report of a mentally disabled American citizen in California who was deported. So, you know, you hear these little specific cases, but, you know, is there something broader to this? And really, on a national scale, how do you even begin to tackle it?
It's dangerous to overemphasize the individual cases. Now, any particular case is unacceptable. We also have to guard against, though, the fears in our community. when we see a slight level increase of ICE enforcement, that is federal law enforcement, going into communities, what we often hear and see are people who are afraid of coming out of their houses. Now, the chances of actually coming across ICE enforcement are pretty limited. What we have to guard against are the types of things where people take it upon themselves to just say, well, we have to move from one county to another because of a law that has been passed. It is difficult. The hostility against Latinos and immigrants, unauthorized and legal immigrants, is very, very high across the country. We are working our best, both in Washington and in some of these local communities, to put a stop to this type of over-aggressive law enforcement.
John Trasviña, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
John Trasviña is president and general counsel of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Everyone is thinking about the economy this week, thinking about the ridiculous prices for milk and gas, thinking about how our tax dollars may be bailing out Wall Street, but maybe not Main Street. And in the middle of it all is the middle class. In the past few years, a record number of Latino families entered the middle class, but a new report charts just how fast Latinos can slip back. The title of the report captures it all, By a Thread, The New Experience of the African American and Latino Middle Class. Tom Shapiro is one of the authors of the report and is the director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. Welcome to Latino USA, Tom.
Well, thank you for having me today.
All right, so many people consider themselves middle class, but not really knowing how to define it. So what exactly makes up, who exactly makes up the middle class?
We define middle class as families earning between $40,000 and $120,000, calibrated by family size.
So when you talk about the fact that the Latino middle class, like the African American middle class, is hanging on by a thread, what are the things that make this thread cut off?
We decided, after looking at a lot of data, that we really wanted to analyze and put together five factors. First, what are the family's financial capacity? What's its wealth-building abilities? Second, what's its level of capacity in terms of education? Third, how much of its income is it spending on housing, whether that's rental or a mortgage? Fourth, how's the family handling its budget? Is there any left over at the end of the year and how much? And then fifth, healthcare. Those are five factors. We set thresholds for each of the five. And for most of them, we decided what threshold a family was at risk for and what level a family had some kind of economic security for. Then we said, all right, if a family has three of those five factors securely in place, for this report, we were going to call that family securely in the middle class. If they had three or more of those five factors at risk for falling out of the middle class, we called them at risk for falling out of the middle class. Just very quickly, nationally, including all races and all ethnicities in America's middle class, about one-third, 31%, hit the secure mark, where one-quarter of those middle-class families are at high risk for falling out. Now, if we ask, what does that look like for the Latino population, we get a more alarming story still. I think the story is distressing for the middle class in America in general. It's even more distressing for the Latino population and for the African-American population. 18% of the middle-class Latino families are secure. 40% fall in the middle, and 41% are at high risk for falling out.
So, Tom, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Melissa Rodriguez is one of the directors of the Latino Economic Development Corporation based in Washington, D.C. She works directly with the Latino community to increase home ownership and small businesses as well. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Let me do this, Melissa. I want to play some tape, actually, for both of you. We sent our producers out across the country to ask people about their primary economic concerns. These are Latinos living in America. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Jeannie Lopez, and I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I would consider myself to be middle class. I don't earn terribly much money, but I do earn enough to save, and that's probably like a nice key component of middle class. I feel like I make a comfortable amount. I do feel financially secure, but I don't feel a lot of job security. So I do worry that if I were to lose my position that, you know, I do have a savings, but I feel like it would dwindle very quickly if I had trouble finding another position.
My name is Marta. I live in Brooklyn. I come from the Dominican Republic. My biggest economic concern is the situation, how much money, you know, I have saved up, if I have enough in case of an emergency or something were to happen to my spouse, you know, a health issue. That's probably the biggest concern that I have right now.
My name is Jorge Valdivia, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And I do consider myself middle class. I think that my parents worked very hard to provide me with a great education, and I think we're a symbol of what a lot of our parents in our communities throughout America have struggled for. In spite of the fact that I feel middle class, I don't feel financially secure. Even though I work hard for what I have, that's just it. I have to work hard for it. No, I don't consider myself to be financially secure.
I'm Robert Stevens. I work for the federal government in Washington, D.C. At this time, I think the real estate market is my chief concern, and obviously gas prices. I see the increase every single day and no relief in sight. So the long-term economic situation in this country is troubling.
Hi, I'm Carlos Tortoledo from Chicago. Well, I got three kids, a house, a garage. I'm the average person. That's boring. Nothing wrong with that. Financial secure. I would say yes, but I mean, yes with a maybe, you know, who knows what 5 years from now or a year from now, right? You know, if I have an accident, something happened to me, would I be financially secure 5 years from now? I don't know.
So here's my sense. I mean, I hear all of these people who we interviewed across the country, and I sense in their voices like some real element of concern. Melissa, when you hear these people saying, look, I don't feel financially secure, a lot of these people had important questions. Well, what do you tell them to do?
It's exciting whenever I hear, you know, people asking these questions, because I think that is the first step in working, you know, daily with Latinos that come in through the door at our organization looking to become homeowners or to start businesses. That's the first thing that we encourage people to do. What are your concerns? What is it that you're trying to achieve? And how can we help you sort of develop a plan to get you there?
Tom, when you hear these concerns raised by these Latinos living in America today, what's your sense? Did you sense, like I did, that these people all sound like they're okay, but boy, a little shaky as well?
Absolutely. You know, I'm hearing anxiety. It's an anxiety, I think, that's built around families having earned their way into the middle class through education, through jobs, through working themselves up at a job ladder, and they may have accumulated a really small, if any, nest egg along the way. And now they're really talking about, as the first voice indicated, insecurity about the job. What happens if that job that got me into the middle class evaporates or is exported? Or what happens if my income is disrupted? I don't have enough to fall back on. Those are all, I think, very fundamental and real anxieties at this point in the American economy that are really built around financial insecurity and trying to think about, how do I not only get ahead, how do I stay ahead? How do I do what I really want to do for my family?
So, Melissa, you, I'm sure, are probably dealing with people who have come in with a sense of economic hope. I mean, you do work with economic development, but I'm sure you also deal with people who have this anxiety issue. So when people say, and a lot of these people said this particular thing, look, I don't have enough savings. So Melissa, when they walk into your office and they say, I'm worried I don't have enough for savings, what do you tell them to do to start saving?
So the first thing that we do when we have the that situation, which happens often, is we sit down with our clients and we help them develop a budget. Let's take a look and see what your income is, what are your expenses, and how can we help you adjust your budget so that we can contribute as much as you can to your savings so that you're going to get the majority of the return and put you and prepare you to be in the best position possible.
Tom Shapiro, one measure of the middle class is home ownership. What we saw in your report and in the news about the housing crisis is that Latinos and African Americans are burdened. Essentially, they're paying too much for their mortgages or their rent vis-a-vis the rest of the population. So what does a family do if they find themselves in this situation?
Middle-class families have to try and adapt. I agree very much with Melissa on the importance of financial literacy and financial capacity, starting with the budget and priorities. At the same time, I also think that we need to be responsible and think about the ways in which financial services and financial products really need to be customized for the kinds of communities that they're serving. And I think that we've seen a wholesale lack of responsibility in the subprime lending crisis. I think we're seeing a wholesale lack of responsibility for the extremely high level of interest rates that are charged on credit cards, for example. I think there are both the individual kinds of actions that we want to talk to families about and help families make better choices, but we also want to be in the business of making better choices so that families can make them, that is, getting more responsibility in the financial service sector.
Tom Shapiro, you're director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University, and thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be with you and your guests.
And Melissa Rodriguez, you're a director with the Latino Economic Corporation based in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us on Latino USA.
Thanks for having me.
And now, permítame que les cuente algo un poco más personal. I was in my own stupor last weekend. I was still reeling, fuming about the governor of New York and his years-long seeming addiction to high-class prostitutes, angry about the unnecessary and base comments by Geraldine Ferraro. I was also upset about talk of the next recession and Wall Street and a run on Bear Stearns. So this was my weekend stupor, and on Saturday I avoided reading the paper or even listening to the news. Imagine my surprise then when on the front page of the Sunday New York Times there was a picture of a huge crane that had collapsed, not in a poor neighborhood, but in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city. And at that moment, I saw my metaphor. This fictitious economy, our Latino middle class, can come crashing down in an instant. If it can happen at Bear Stearns on Wall Street and blocks away from the United Nations, how can I be sure it won't happen to me or to my family? My sister's husband has been laid off and unemployed, and I watched her navigate on her teacher's salary. Meanwhile, working-class new immigrants just work harder and longer hours for less pay. I know for these families, many of them will end up doubling up, and those of us who do lose our jobs will turn to others in our families for help in a bad pinch. But how many of us just don't have that safety net? And how many of us are being reckless, buying into the American dream where it's all about consumption, the culture of consumption? I like to believe that I live a life filled with self-criticism, so I catch myself when I'm spending too much, and I tell my kids about how to avoid getting into debt, how to become critical consumers. But I keep coming back to that image of the crane, crumbled like a broken toy on the posh east side of Manhattan, a symbol of just how much we are teetering, and just how much we all need to become critical thinkers and critical consumers in this fictitious economy. In a minute, La Lucha por la Paz, fighting for peace in Colombia, and a remembrance of labor activist Emma Tenayuca, coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The emergence of the middle class after the Great Depression was due in no small part to the organizing work done by labor unions. And in San Antonio, Texas, that work for 12,000 pecan shellers was done by one woman, Emma Tenayuca. Texas Public Radio's Yvette Benavides has our story.
Explore the city of San Antonio and you will not find a street named for pioneering activist Emma Tenayuca. There's no statue of her or school named in her honor or even a historic plaque describing Tenayuca's accomplishments as one of the first Latina civil rights leaders. But still, Tenayuca is remembered. Her story is spread mainly through word of mouth by the people of San Antonio. At Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio's largely Latino West Side, a play is presented about the life of Tenayuca. It's told through the eyes of a Latina college student discovering Tenayuca's amazing story.
How come we never heard about her in school? She was a civil rights leader. We heard about Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and she was almost 30 years ahead of them.
It was 70 years ago, during the Great Depression, that Tenayuca led a successful strike against a local cigar company and then four pecan workers. These workers were mainly Mexican-American women, cracking and picking out the pecans by hand. They earned pennies for each pound of pecans shelled. The typical worker earned between $2 and $3 per week. In a rare interview that Tenayuca recorded in 1987, she becomes upset talking about the terrible living conditions the pecan workers endured.
Only recently that I have been able to talk about some of the things that I saw here, I mean as far as poverty, because it was just too difficult.
Tenayuca explains that only 12% of the workers had running water in their homes and 9% had inside sanitary toilets. Tenayuca then organized the pecan shellers and led 12,000 laborers in a two-month work stoppage. The strike gained national and international attention when local police were used to arrest and jail many of the strikers, including Tenayuca. In March 1938, both sides agreed to arbitration. The workers and Tenayuca had won. She was 21 years old at the time.
Emma Tenayuca is one of the most significant Latina leaders in this nation, because she conducted what historians consider to be the very first successful mass political action in the Mexican-American struggle for justice.
Author Carmen Tafoya is writing a biography on Tenayuca, and she's published a children's book about her called That's Not Fair. Tafoya says Tenayuca remains controversial today mainly because she was a communist. The city leaders saw Tenayuca as a threat to their political machine. They accused her of being part of a red plot to seize control of the city's west side. And one night at a communist rally at the city's municipal auditorium, there was a confrontation. Tafoya says a mob of thousands gathered to violently disrupt the meeting.
The mob outside was infuriated. They broke in through the windows. They ripped out seats in the auditorium. They tore the auditorium apart. There was a lynch mob there, yes.
Tenayuca managed to escape the mob, but continued to receive death threats and was blacklisted. She was forced to flee San Antonio.
Went to San Francisco and stayed there for 20 years. And to my surprise, I returned and I find myself some sort of a heroine.
Tenayuca was not forgotten, and even up until her death in 1999, she continued to call for economic justice for Latinos and all workers. But still today, if you want to learn about Tenayuca and her struggle for social justice, you won't find her story in Texas history textbooks. There's been almost an overt effort to prevent her story from being taught in schools. Tafoya says that's because Tenayuca challenged the status quo and won. But despite her lack of historic recognition, Tenayuca's legacy continues today. She was the first to show Latinos the importance of organizing to demand better treatment, higher wages, and justice in the workplace. In San Antonio, I'm Yvette Benavides, reporting for Latino USA.
When I was a little boy, my father took me to La Quinta de San Pedro Alejandrino in Santa Marta, Colombia, the death place of Simón Bolívar, perhaps the most famous liberator of Spanish South America.
For commentator John Guardo, it was the dream of unity that defeated the calls for war in his homeland of Colombia.
As we walked through the halls of the adjacent museum, El Museo Bolivariano. He explained to me how Simón Bolívar had once brought together a trio of South American nations into one grand republic as the first step in his dream of uniting all of Latin America. Ecuador, Venezuela, and Colombia still carry traces of Bolívar's vision in their flags. In sharing the same national colors, yellow, blue, and red, I have always felt a kinship with Ecuadorians and Venezuelans. So I was troubled when I learned that these three sister nations may be going to war as a result of Colombia's recent military operation against the country's Revolutionary Armed Forces, or FARC, which ended up spilling onto Ecuadorian soil. Ecuador's response was to condemn Colombia and cut off diplomatic relations. Venezuela somehow got involved and upped the ante by readying its troops and military hardware in support of Ecuador. Living in the U.S. as a Colombian expatriate, I didn't know what to make of this news other than to worry, so I made a long-distance call to my pops in Barranquilla, located on Colombia's Atlantic coast, not too far from the Venezuelan border, in order to get his take on the situation. My father told me that Colombians and Venezuelans have always been like siblings and that the possibility of an armed encounter was highly disturbing. Then his tone went from one of rain to one of sunshine, as he described the happy atmosphere that enveloped Barranquilla after the respective leaders shook hands at the summit in Rio. My pop's take mostly dealt with neighboring Venezuela, though, so I was compelled to reach out to some of my best friends here, who are Ecuadorians by birth. When this all broke out, I was scared that my friends and compatriots would get all nationalistic and our relationships would be affected. But in speaking with them, I was very happy to discover that our love and respect for one another and for peace itself far superseded any disagreements and saber-rattling taking place at the highest levels of our country's governments. We ended the conversation with a heartfelt handshake, and that image lingered in my head, reminding me of a song by Colombian music star Juanes.
Hagamos todos una bandera con manos negras. Una bandera con manos blancas por un mundo mejor.
His vision of many different peoples coming together under one flag reminded me of Simón Bolívar's own dream, especially since it involves the same sister nations. Like Juanes says, we are all brothers and sisters. We're equals. We just have to raise one flag together, the flag of peace.
John Guardo works for public radio and is a writer based in New York City. Latino USA was produced this week by Benjamin Jacob, Walter Morgan, Alex Avila, and Angela Maldonado. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from Robert Frazier, Katie Davis, and Kirk Carapeza. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.